listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. A Cultural Awakening, the Year of You. The challenges of this year have brought about an undeniable cultural shift. It became a time of introspection for many, a time to pull together as a community to support those on the front lines, a time to be thankful for the little things in life. Anywhere you turned, the proverbial they were talking about this mindset reset. It was, and still is, all about taking care of your mental health. Mental Health America warns that this year has had a profound effect on those 1 in 5 people with existing mental health conditions, not to mention the 1 in 2 who are at risk of developing them. To help, there has been a flood of advice flowing from many sources. Take, for example, the World Health Organization's 132-page booklet on coping and stress management, which details practical skills, self-help techniques, and other anxiety-relieving exercises. Arguably, one of the most important ways to de-stress and overcome anxiety is to focus on joy. What is it that makes you truly happy? What are some of the things you can do to disconnect and de-stress? As we say goodbye to 2020, thankfully, we look ahead to a new year, one that hopefully will be defined by a renewed sense of self. Because if you don't take care of yourself, there is no way you can take care of others. Here are some of the ways you can connect without being connected: finding joy in the quiet times, in what moves you, building upon your passions. Try one or try all. Take a moment of joyful focus and build what you're passionate about. Mindfulness. Carve out 5 minutes at the beginning of the day to set your intentions for what you want your day to look like. Read. Escape to a whole new world and expand your horizons by reading a book, no matter the genre or length. Lose yourself in what you enjoy. Bring back past joys. Rediscover the joy of building with Lego sets. Build your own creations, or try adult models like the Dubai skyline from Lego Architecture, or delve into the latest pop culture trend, mosaic builds, as seen in Lego art Andy Warhol's Marilyn Monroe portraits. Physical focus. Whether you love to hit it hard at boot camp or circuit training, or like to find your center with yoga and Pilates, discover what suits you and get up and get going. Nostalgia of road trips. From hitting the open road to mastering hobbies, old and new, just go for what brings you joy. Thank you. full stride, Manolo Blahnik, the designer behind one of the world's most beloved luxury shoe brands, has dreamed up his hit styles at much the same place since 1970, a desk in his London office by Daisy Shaw Ellis. Photographs by Junie Woodward. In memoriam, Mrs. Diana Vreeland and Mrs. Anna Piaggi were my mentors. Tina Chow was my beloved friend. I think of them every day. Inspiration via Raquel Welch. The mementos hanging from the lamp change constantly, depending on what inspires me at that time. The photo of Raquel is the starting point for my SS 2021 collection. She typifies a natural, sexy elegance. Apollonia in her youth. I have 16 dogs. The golden girl Apollonia is my favorite. Such a beauty. She just had 6 puppies. Faber-Castell pencils. My initial sketches begin with pencils. I work with such ease whilst using them. Dr. P. H. Martin ink. The majority of the drawing is done with inks. Dr. P. H. Martin's of New York is my utmost favorite. Polka dot Oxfords. I only wear my own shoes. I always have a few different pairs under my desk. Fragrance. Knees Tin and Penhaligon's are my alternating fragrances. I have worn them for decades. Magnifier. Alas, one of the problems of dealing with small print. This is an indispensable tool. And that was My Desk with Manolo Blahnik. Thank you. Hero's Journey. Actor Jacob Elordi is a romantic on-screen and off by Britt Hinemuth, with photograph by Luke Guilford. Every generation has its heartthrobs. Gen Z has Jacob Elordi. The Lothario of streaming, thanks to Netflix's The Kissing Booth trilogy, shocked Hollywood as a demented jock in HBO's Euphoria. Next, he'll tangle with Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas in Adrian Lyne's erotic adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's classic thriller Deep Water. This Australian-born movie buff is picking his roles to build a leading man that lasts. Elordi was auditioning for Australian soaps in Sydney and studying Noah Baumbach films when he landed The Kissing Booth. I'm a purist and love the movie theater, so I had this weird moral battle of what am I aiding and abetting? Am I the face of this robotic, terrifying new age? Am I murdering this thing that I love? But there was this mentality of, I'll do whatever the F I've got to do to get to the United States and do what I love. The movie spawned two sequels. This is really the last kiss, he says of the final installation. He fumbled his Euphoria audition, but he got a call back and met Sam Levinson. He will stop at nothing to get that goal. To be one of the soldiers out there for him, that's the environment I love to work in. He wasn't surprised when Zendaya made Emmy history as the youngest ever best actress in a drama series. She's a power unto herself and so talented, such a sweetheart. Affleck, his colleague in Deep Water, is a hero. I have a picture in my house of him and Matt Damon with the Oscars for Good Will Hunting, and he was thrilled to work with Lyne following his nearly 20-year hiatus. Elordi plays Charlie, a classical pianist and lover to De Armas' character. She had me on my toes and was surprising every single take. His perfect date is a night in Paris with wine and you're dressed to the nines, but he's still adjusting to dating in the public eye and has been snapped jet-setting with model Kaya Gerber. You want it to be genuine and real and have all the feelings of what you read in 1920s literature, but when people are watching and talking about it, it makes it a little bit difficult. Gone Country. During a year marked by calls for racial justice, progressive voices have found success in a genre once inhospitable to dissent. Aaron Vanderhoof. South Gotta Change by Ajay Victoria. The Nashville-based crooner teamed up with T-Bone Burnett for a percussive anthem that vows not to let her homeland slip away. Black Like Me by Mickey Guyton. Released in the days after George Floyd's death, this song describes, in a musical style dominated by white men, growing up black. Better Than We Found It by Maren Morris. After welcoming a son this spring, the Grammy winner wrote this ode to improving the world. Long Violent History by Tyler Childers. The Kentucky-born bluegrass musician draws connections between the Appalachian tradition of protest songs and demands for equality in cities like Louisville. My Stuff, Cool Operator. Emmy winner and Lancome face Zendaya shares her creature comforts amid a roller coaster year. Style file, go-to shoe, white Reeboks or black Chucks. Wardrobe staple, my long black Ralph Lauren coat. I can put it over anything and look dressed up. Closet treasure, all of my vintage T-shirts. I miss shopping at vintage stores around the world. On beauty, facialist Vanessa Mark Spa. Lip balm, Aquaphor, it works for literally everything. Night out makeup, Lancome Lash Idol. It lengthens and separates my lashes and is never clumpy. Fantasy hair, short pixie. I wanted to cut my hair like 12 times during quarantine, but work makes it nearly impossible. Toothpaste, Sensodyne. Shower kit, Philip Kingsley shampoo for my scalp, peppermint soap, and exfoliating gloves. Perfume, Lancome Idole Intense, which just smells like happy memories. Scents are emotional like that for me. The menu, morning beverage, just water. Indulgence, Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream. Snack, acai bowls from Ubatuba. Sweet home, flower. I have gardenias growing in my backyard, my favorite flower, so that's very special. Favorite seat, anywhere on my couch because it's the kind of couch you can sink into. Heirloom, my grandfather's desk. Scent, Mojito Candle by Malin and Goetz. Artwork, I have a painting by Genesis Tremaine, who is based out of New Jersey. Leisure studies, recently watched I May Destroy You. Classic movie, Moulin Rouge. Road trip music, Ungodly Hour by Chloe and Hallie. Workflow, on-set essentials, comfy clothes I can easily pull on top of my costume. Souvenir, Rue's hoodie from Euphoria. We're on the road to nowhere. If getting there is half the fun, why not make the journey the destination? By Sloane Crosley. Consider the Australians. They've had an especially hard year. In addition to enduring a biblical time on the ground, these are people who are born to travel. If you've ever been to a coffee shop in Los Angeles, this is not new information. Qantas is one of the oldest airlines on the planet. In the 90s, the now-defunct Ansett Airlines offered mystery flights, popular day-long excursions, to surprise destinations throughout the continent. Apparently, the thrill of watching one city recede overrode the stress of blind packing. Yes, Australians have long known what the rest of the world has only begun to realize, that travel is more about the getting out than the getting to. This mindset is key to understanding why airlines in Australia and other countries have begun pushing alternative or faux excursions during this time of lengthy quarantines and indefinite travel bans. Flights to nowhere, care for an $800 swoop over the Great Barrier Reef? What about a first-class sojourn over Antarctica? Still cold. Might seem gimmicky and environmentally abhorrent, because they are. There's no such thing as a reasonable offsetting of carbon emissions for a passenger flight that can't even funnel money into an ailing tourist destination. Or, as one commentator put it, after the New York Times ran a piece on such flights, like Royal Brunei's Dine and Fly program, people miss flying, being in a tin can in the air, squashed together like sardines, the stale recirculated air, other people's saliva full of coronavirus, bags of stale peanuts, horrible food, tiny, nasty bathrooms. Do they also miss waterboarding and state-sanctioned torture? Fair enough, but these things are selling out. As someone who pines for vital yet inaudible subway announcements, I get it. It's no great leap to imagine the type of person who finds window shopping pleasurable would gladly accept a portion of a vacation. There are also those who genuinely relish the pod-like surrender of a metal tube. The Taiwanese know of what I speak. Before COVID-19, Taipei's Songshan Airport had undergone an expensive facelift. So the airport partnered with China Airlines to create a virtual flight with all the prized logistical annoyances, taxi, check-in, security, and none of the back pain. The flight never took off. If this seems too reminiscent of a grim chapter in Station 11, there's always the flight that looped around South Korea's Jeju Island, offering a Korean cultural lecture on board. The Japanese have taken the trend to aesthetic heights. In addition to their own boomerang flights, some flights on All Nippon Airways, originally bound for Hawaii, have been repurposed as sightseeing tours of Tokyo. The Terra-only company First Airlines has created a simulated aviation facility. Here, you will find virtual reality headsets and virtual clouds whizzing past virtual windows in a virtual first-class cabin. The meals are real and not, say, aspic, which is incongruous for a Kubrickian tea party. But okay, not to be outdone, Japan Airlines has begun remote trips. No carbon emissions, no quarantine, no pants. Remote trips take place over Zoom, with individuals being sent snacks and keepsakes from destinations like the Oki Islands. In one screenshot of the maiden voyage, you can see passengers in their respective homes, smiling with their seashells. For now, should you plug remote trip into Google, you will still be offered the old schema, images of far-flung islands and desolate shores, plus international travel, while limited and prohibitive, is not impossible. In August, I boarded an actual plane to an actual destination, rural England. Upon landing, there was endless signage warning me that at any minute I'd have to fork over my contact tracing form. Get ready, it's going to happen. But no one collected it. On top of which, the doors of the automated passport machine were jammed, which is how, in the middle of a pandemic, I waltzed into England. I had concerns about this accidental espionage. If there was no record of me arriving, would I have issues departing? But 2 weeks later, I had my passport and temperature checked at JFK, where I was released into the city without incident. It turns out, you can always come home, even if it's from a place you've never really been. The next media gold rush. Journalists are flocking to Substack. But is the budding newsletter empire built to last? By Joe Pompeo. With photograph by Maurizio Catalan and Pier Paolo Ferrari, which shows a set of hands typing on a vintage bright yellow typewriter, and each finger has a thimble on the end. Between the collapse of newspapers, the misfortunes of digital media, and the economic wreckage of the coronavirus pandemic, writing for a living can feel like a cold, dreary, morale-sucking march to the unemployment office. And yet, there's a hopeful sentiment heard lately in journalist circles. It feels like the beginning of the gold rush. That gold rush is Substack, and the man handing out pickaxes is a 33-year-old Silicon Valley techie named Chris Best, who serves as CEO of the Au Courant publishing platform for email newsletter scribes. Substack newsletters are growing in influence and numbers, and in many cases, they're becoming a no-brainer for marquee writers and reporters who want to make a comfortable salary, quite possibly a very comfortable one, without having a boss. If we succeed in our ambitions, Best told me, one of the things we hope is that this is a better model than the way things work now. Substack's thousands of writers span left and right, conventional and contrarian, old media and new. It's got reporters, academics, talking heads, political strategists, finance wonks, Christians, controversials, and crypto enthusiasts. To date, there are more than 250,000 subscriptions across the network. At the top of the ladder, tens of thousands of people pay $5 a month to read A-listers like Matt Taibbi and Andrew Sullivan or breakthrough historian Heather Cox Richardson. Lefties flock to Judd Legum's popular information and right-wingers to Eric Erickson's Confessions of a Political Junkie. Remember Mark Halperin, whose lucrative journalism career came to a screeching halt during the hashtag MeToo movement? He's a Substacker now. Click a button and you can fill your inbox with dispatches from the likes of former Obama advisor Dan Pfeiffer, China expert Bill Bishop, advice guru Heather Havrileski, economist cum parenting expert cum soothing COVID-19 researcher Emily Oster, and many more. Oster's newsletter is among a subset of free ones. It was just the right time, said Anne Helen Peterson, who left her job as a senior culture writer at BuzzFeed in August to focus full-time on a Substack newsletter. There were several factors in the decision, she said, from the precariousness of digital media over the course of the pandemic to wanting more creative freedom and writing without the burdens of gaming headlines to play on social media. Still, to get Peterson over the finish line, the Substack brass agreed to cover her health insurance and the hiring of a features editor. She took a lump payment for the first year, she declined to say how much, and agreed to let Substack keep 85% of her subscriber revenue. Other writers take no money up front and keep 90% of what subscribers pay at a variety of rates. It could be $5 or $7 a month, $50 or $60 a year, and so on. The Made for Dummies user interface makes the whole experience pretty seamless. As Peterson put it, the writers joining Substack are regaining control of our own journalism. The company, which was incubated by Y Combinator in 2017 before raising $15.3 million last year, in a Series A round led by venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, remains relatively small. As of this fall, there were 18 employees, including Best two co-founders, Hamish McKenzie, COO, and Jairaj Sethi, CTO. They don't have an office yet. COVID put those plans on hold, and there's still a scrappy teamwork ethos when it comes to handling the laborious stuff like customer service. But between the buzz and the metastasizing roster of brand name bylines, Substack feels like a player that might just be on the cusp of the big leagues. They are the great white hope of media right now, said Om Malik, a partner at True Ventures. People are looking to latch onto something positive. There isn't much positive left. When Substack launched in July 2017, McKinsey published an essay likening it to the penny newspapers that sprouted up in Victorian America, revolutionizing the industry with their dirt-cheap newsstand price and cornucopia of ads. Benjamin Day radically altered the future of journalism with a tweak to its funding model, McKinsey wrote, referring to the publisher of the original New York Sun. Almost two centuries later, the news industry is ready for another reinvention. Best leaned into that analogy when we video chatted in late September. He was in San Francisco, where he lives with his wife and almost 1 year old. "I don't think we aspire to just be on par with traditional publishing," said the neatly bearded founder, looking very startup casual in a plain gray t-shirt. "I think we can be something bigger and more important. It sounds ridiculously grandiose, but we are setting out to make something that is better than what came before. Is there another fundraising round on the horizon? We're in a position where if we never raised money again, we could comfortably become profitable and grow at the same rate. What about a future sale? Our ambition is to become a successful independent company." I ask Best for an example of some moment when it really started to feel like this thing was catching fire. "Doing customer support," he said, "there have been numerous times when I realize I'm talking to someone that's more famous than I ever imagined I'd be talking to." He was too polite to name names. As far as millennial CEOs go, Best name recognition is somewhere between a person you've never heard of and, say, a Kevin Systrom or Evan Spiegel. He grew up outside Vancouver and studied systems design engineering at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. There, he and several classmates created the smartphone messaging app Kik, where Sethi, a fellow Waterloo alum, worked as a developer, and McKinsey, a New Zealand-born former tech reporter, joined as an editorial advisor. The trio broke away from Kik in 2017, and then poof, Substack. For all of Substack's visionary tough talk, it's hard to imagine a mass exodus, a voluntary one at least, from major media organizations. A steady paycheck is still a steady paycheck. And it still counts for something to tell a source you're calling from a publication like the New York Times, The Atlantic, or Politico, not to mention the institutional backing that such outlets provide. Substack recently started offering legal support for its writers. Plus, doing a paid newsletter is an endless slog. You've got to keep your readers satiated, make them feel like they can't live without you in their inbox. But for those with the talent, the will, and a sizable Twitter following, it's an attractive proposition. In September, after tech journalist Casey Newton announced he was leaving Vox Media's The Verge in the hopes that his 20,000 newsletter readers would follow him over to Substack, Columbia Journalism Review's Matthew Ingram observed, "Even if only 20% of those people sign up to pay, that still works out to $400,000 a year. An initial paid conversion rate of 1 to 5% would probably be more realistic." Emily Akin, who writes the must-read climate digest Heated, is another Substack star. Early in her career, she got all the right jobs: New York Observer intern, research assistant to late investigative journalist Wayne Barrett, New Republic staff writer. But it wasn't until she started a Substack newsletter in 2019 that she became one of the most influential climate journalists. In just over a year, Heated racked up 32,527 total subscribers and about 3,500 paying ones. Her paid subscribers get the full smorgasbord of content. She made about $230,000 in 2020 before subtracting Substack's 10% cut and other expenses. Prior to this, Atkin, who just turned 31, had never made more than $75,000 in any of her other jobs. "I had basically accepted that I would never make enough money to buy a nice house," she said. "So this is unlike anything I ever imagined for myself, that I could make a real adult, like nonprofit lawyer's salary," It takes a certain combination of expertise, prose, and hustle to hit numbers like that. But the point is, it's attainable. And if Substack's recruiting spree continues to lure high-profile writers and journalists with big audiences, Best believes they'll have the market cornered, despite competition from less established rivals like Ghost and Lead. Some consumers, he noted, are more willing to pay to read one of their favorite writers than they are to pay for Netflix. If we're successful, said Best, yes, Substack will be much bigger. Malik, himself a longtime newsletter writer, though not with Substack, and founder of the tech blog GigaUm, is generally optimistic about the company's chances. As a former media guy, I would like my industry peers to survive and thrive and do well, and I think Substack shows them the way, he said. Then came the caveat. People shouldn't forget that it is for profit. It is venture-backed. They will have to kneel down at the altar of growth sooner or later, and growth does take its toll even on the most noble of causes.
Thank you.
Here's what's trending. Fresh powder. Items that pair perfectly with rosy cheeks and hot mugs, keeping you warm whether on the slopes or snowy sidewalks. Van Cleef & Arpels earrings. Y Project and Canada Goose parka. Deuce & Deuce & Lenticular large puzzle. Guess cardigan. Your mask. Heel whipped skin souffle. Givenchy sunglasses. Max Mara coat. Chloe & Fussell jumpsuit. Dior men skis. Coco Neige de Chanel boots. 20th century Russian illustrator Fyodor Stepanovich Rodionovsky's After Skiing makes a strong case that the best part of the sport is lodge fashion. A Showtime documentary series directed by Matt Ternauer, who did Where's My Roy Cohn, Studio 54, and Valentino, The Last Emperor, The Reagans, Control the Myth, and You Control the Masses, premiered November 15th at 8 p.m. on Showtime. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.